Good morning, everyone. This story of the prodigal son is, by almost everyone's account, one of the most beautiful stories in the Bible, most likely because, of course, God the Father just comes and welcomes the son, and one feels so loved and just received unconditionally. I'm sure it brings up that human emotion in us, really, of constantly wanting to be loved unconditionally like that. But it's just such a very beautiful story. Swami didn't tell the whole story in this reading today. He, of course, went right to the very meaningful part of God waiting there with that unconditional love. But I'd like to just share this story a little with you before we move on from it. And I imagine most of you know it, but we'll retell it here now. There is a farmer who has two sons, and the younger son approaches the farmer, his father, at some point, and says to him, "I'd like you to divide your wealth now. I want to take what is mine," he says to his father, "and do with it as I will." So the farmer does as his son requests. He divides his wealth in half, and he gives the younger son his due, at which point the son leaves the farm and goes off. And the words in the Bible are very interesting. Some of them Swamiji quotes here, some of them he doesn't. But he says he goes into a foreign land, and he squanders his wealth on what is called in the Bible, in certain interpretations of the Bible, riotous living. And Swamiji refers to it at some point as loose living. He uses both terms. A little challenging for us yogis to imagine it has anything to do with us, because probably there's not many people here who would think they would go out and do something called riotous living. But the story is, of course, about each of us. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And then a famine takes over, or comes upon the land. And he loses everything that he had. He squandered all of his wealth already, so he has nothing now. So in the midst of this famine, he goes to another farmer and asks for a job. And he's given a job of feeding the pigs, of feeding the swine. But he has nothing to eat for himself, nothing for himself. He finds himself longing to even eat what he's feeding the pigs, even that. But it says in the Bible, but that was not offered to him. When it dawns on him that the people who work for his father, the people who are in his father's land, have plenty of bread and plenty to eat, and it dawns on him that he should go back and ask his father for a job. At least then he wouldn't be hungry. And it's with that attitude that he goes home, and we hear. He says, "I've sinned before you and before heaven. I'm undeserving of anything, but will you just give me a job?" And of course, the importance, or one important aspect of the story, is that his father, who of course represents the divine here, sees none of that. It's not as if he has to acknowledge what his son has done, acknowledge the sin, acknowledge his son's riotous or loose living. Not like that. He doesn't even see it. Before his son even gets close to him, as his son is running his scenario through in his mind, saying to himself, "I'm going to just go to my father and I'm going to say, look, I've sinned before you in heaven. I don't deserve anything. I know that. But could I just have a job? Could I feed your pigs?" he wants to say to his father. But the father doesn't see that. The father sees, here is my son. He sees him as being absolutely perfect, as he always was. He doesn't see him as having made any mistakes, anything that he needs to apologize for, make up for. He doesn't hold him in that light. He never saw him like that. He always only saw him as being perfect, which is, of course, how God sees us. And Swamiji says, we as humans notice these qualities in ourselves and others. That is not what is true for the divine. But it's hard for us to know that as we think about it, as we analyze it, as we process it through our mind. The allegory in the story is compelling. First, he says, the sun goes off to a foreign land. And what does he mean by that? He means this is very much like our story of the little bird, our festival that we tell every Sunday. Many of you know that story. Others of you who may not will get to hear it today. But it's exactly the story in the festival. The sun goes off to a foreign land, which means he leaves his place as being one with God, his home in the divine, his connection to the divine, and goes into the world of ego and materialism. And he's going to decide to live there. He's drawn out there. He's lured out there through his senses. And then the famine comes. And what is that famine, that place of extraordinary hunger in all of us? Because we're out there no matter how much we're trying in this life to satisfy our needs, to find fulfillment. Where God does not exist, we won't find it. We are living in a veritable famine. And then it talks about having him feed the swine, feed the pigs, which means he's taking care of all of those ego needs, all of his desires, one by one by one. And of course, we know they're endless. But that's what he's doing. That's basically what these swine represent, are all of our ego-centered needs, all of the delusion, all of our desires, all of our likes and dislikes. And then he talks about returning home. And returning home means remembering, really. It means coming back to that place of oneness with God. So right in this one little parable, we have our entire journey of being lured away from the divine, of being sent out, of trying to satisfy ourselves, trying to make ourselves be happy, feel fulfilled in a virtually impossible situation, because we're looking everywhere but where there is divine love for us. And the riotous living, the loose living, really is about that constant need to satisfy it. Again, it doesn't sound like much to us yogis, but I had a really profound experience over the past few days. I went to Colorado to visit my brother and his family. And my brother lives about 30 miles west of Aspen. I don't know how many of you have been to Aspen, but Aspen is a perfect manifestation of everything worldly, material, ego-centered. And when I say perfect, I mean an exquisite manifestation of it. It sits in this perfect little valley that's surrounded by these 14,000 feet peaks in the Rockies. We had driven up. I'd landed in Denver, rented a car, and driven up. And there was a big snowstorm that day. So all of the mountains were covered with snow. But the next 3 days when I was actually visiting, the temperatures were in the high 30s, mid 40s. So it was very warm. Those beautiful, bright blue Colorado skies. I'm not sure where else they exist. It's really quite spectacular. And right at the bottom of all of these, excuse me, ski slopes is this town, with one building being more beautiful than the next, one person being more beautiful than the next, everybody dressed in the most exquisite clothing, fur-lined hoods. I mean this really, these beautiful down jackets, beautiful ski equipment, every store is just manicured, hand-carved wood. I mean, it was designed to tempt the ego. And they did a perfect job. It's really quite something. So I'm there with this family of mine and a friend who went with me, and we parked the car. We're just going to walk around town for an hour and a half, 2 hours, have lunch. My very young niece is with us, and she wants me to meet her friends. So I said, okay, I'll drive to Aspen with you and meet your friends. The first store we walk into has in it, as I said, really beautiful clothing, perfect clothing. The first thing I touch is this gorgeous cashmere sweater, 100% finest cashmere, $295. And I say to myself, you could really use a sweater. And you know what the truth is? I really probably could use another sweater. It's the truth. I actually don't shop all that much for myself. I get dressed most days and go to work. And I start telling myself, and I start feeling each of the sweaters and deciding on which style I would buy. And then I said to myself, you may need a sweater. But number one, you do not need a $295 sweater. And number two, you are not buying one thing while you're in Aspen, Colorado. And I stood there very quietly and very still, and I told everybody I would meet them outside. And we went into the next store, and I got very still in the next store. And finally, my little niece, Kristen, says to me, Aunt Shanti, what are you doing? And I said, Kristen, I'm stopping store by store, and I'm reminding myself who I really am. And I realized that shopping in Aspen, Colorado for me, which would have been a hoot, to say the least, would be my version, our version of riotous living, of loose living. It doesn't look the way it looks in the prodigal son story. That's not who we are. We're not out drinking and carousing and whatever else he was doing, whatever one conjures up in their mind about loose living. No. We go into the most sophisticated town in the world and we buy cashmere sweaters and everything else we can have. But here's the thing that's important about all of this. We do these things and we decide and we tell ourselves we've sinned in front of God. We've made a mistake. We're not worth anything. We're not worthy of even food to eat. Let's just keep feeding our pigs. I remember many years ago, and some of you have heard me tell this story, I separated from my husband, who I had been with for a lot of years. We had a beautiful relationship. The separation continues to be a bit of a wonder to me. People always say, why? And to this day, I just say, I don't know. And I don't. But nonetheless, I left. I felt horrible about it. And I sat in front of my altar every morning and every night for 2 years. 2 years. What is 365 times two? Morning and night. And I swore to God, I promised him that I would not let myself be happy again until Barry was happy. Every day, twice a day, until one day I heard a voice. I didn't analyze this. I didn't figure it out. God came to me. I know that for sure. And he said to me, Shanti, you think this is what I want from you? And it came to me. This is not what God wants. Of course it's not what God wants. But it is what we do. We decide that we've made a mistake, that we're awful, that we're not worthy. This is no surprise to God that we go out and do these things. We are simply living out our karma. At one point, I remember Ananta saying during a talk, you think God is surprised by our delusions? He created delusion. He's not surprised that we're living it. All he wants is for us to remember to turn around and come back. I love this story in Autobiography of a Yogi. Master gives it two chapters. It's beautiful. The first is the chapter on the sleepless saint, and then an experience of cosmic consciousness, because it's Master's version of exactly this story. Here's this soul who came in as an avatar who's with his guru, and he comes to him one day, and he says to Sri Yukteswar, "Will you please give me your blessings? I want to go into the Himalayas. I want to have an experience of cosmic consciousness. And I'm sure that if I go there and I stay completely silent, I'll be able to find that." And Sri Yukteswar just says to him, "You know, there are a lot of men waiting in the Himalaya who have not really had an experience of God. Maybe it would be better for you to find that experience through a God-realized being instead of some inert stone." But Master persisted, and he argued with Sri Yukteswar. He said to him, "No, I have to go there. That's where I can have this experience." So, of course, Sri Yukteswar did what God does. He just stayed silent. And Master says in Autobiography of Yogi, I don't have the exact words, but adorably, he said, "Just the way the ego wants to do, I decided to take that as a sign of my master's approval. I was supposed to go into the mountains." So he goes into the Himalayas. He actually has a couple of wonderful experiences. But when he asks the sleepless saint to give him an experience of samadhi, the saint says to him, "No, first of all, you're not ready. You couldn't handle it if I gave it to you. Furthermore, you have a guru at home. God is waiting for you. Turn around and go back to the divine, and that's where you can have this experience." And in the next chapter, Master opens that chapter by saying, "I sort of sheepishly walked in, and he said, 'Hi, Master, I'm home.' He said, I tried to say it as if hours and not days had passed." And Sri Yukteswar just says to him, "Let's go to the kitchen and get something to eat." And Yogananda is totally taken. He said, "You mean you're not angry with me?" And Yukteswar says, "Of course I'm not angry with you." He said, "That kind of," what's the word he's using? I'm blocking on it right now. But he says, basically, that kind of angst can only come up if one has thwarted desires. I don't expect anything of you. I have a desire for you to know God. But I have no expectations of you in that way. How could I be angry with you?" You remember the story that Swamiji tells in The Path, where one of the monks had done something, and he looks at Master and he says, "Oh, but Master, you will forgive me, won't you?" And Master just looked at him perplexed and said, "How could I do anything else? What else could I do?" he says. "What else could I do but forgive you?" And it's really not even a question about forgiveness. It's about just celebrating each of our moments of turning back, of turning into the light, of remembering that all we need to do is to turn our attention that way, and that we will be there, that we will be exactly where we want to be. God will be waiting. When we were in Encinitas, a month ago or so now. No, it wasn't in Encinitas. I think it happened at Lake Shrine. One of the monks was talking to us. He was a very sweet man. And somebody asked him a question. And he said, "Well, of course." He said, "I have my story of when Master came to me." And then he looked at all of us in this group of about 45 at that point, and he said, "We all have our story. We all have that moment where we were able to turn and feel the light again. Our job is to keep refocusing our attention there. Our job is to remember these techniques that we've been given, to keep saying Hung Sa no matter how many times we do it. Master doesn't care how many times we trip and fall. We care. We decide that we're wrong. we decide that God is angry with us. God would never be angry with us. I was wondering, just asking myself this question, why do we do that? I mean this really in a way, why do we hold on to the kind of guilt that we can know and beating ourselves up? Why did I sit there for 2 years swearing that I wouldn't be happy? And I hear people say it all the time. It's so simple. It takes no time. It just takes remembering the first technique we learn when we're here. Hung Saw. I am that. That is the only thing that's keeping us from all that's awesome in this universe. I thought to myself, just like in this story of the crucifixion, and we've all heard Asha say this many times, and it's so right. Of course, the crucifixion is powerful, and there's a lot in it. But the extraordinary part of that story is the resurrection. It's really knowing that what happened to that body, what happened to Jesus, is not the story. It's not the truth. There is no body. The soul lives. The soul is eternal. And that is exactly what's the point here. It doesn't matter how many times we fall. The story is not in the fall. The story that we're here to live is in the getting back up, standing up, going at it again, turning our attention again. Hung Saw. We are not meant to live in the midst of that fall. We're meant to live in our hearts, to know God there. We're meant to live at the spiritual eye. It doesn't matter that we go down. We just turn around. We bring ourselves back up. We offer ourselves again. There's one of the blogs that I think Davey wrote it in the blog that Jyotish and Davey do every week called A Touch of Light. And I've mentioned these before. Many of us have. They're these little touches of light that are meant to be read in a minute. So everybody can read them. You don't file them to read them later and never get to them. But one of them was written many months ago now when they were in Italy on their way to India. It was called When God Speaks. And it's interesting today in terms of this story for two reasons. They're in Italy, so they're in Assisi. And she tells the story of St. Francis. But she starts it very sweetly. She says, you know, 800 years ago, there was a young boy here who had been living riotously. Francis was known. He was a party guy. He loved to party. And he loved to put on big parties and invite all of his friends. And there was a lot of drinking and a lot of singing through the streets. But she goes on to tell the story of what happens to him at San Damiano when Jesus comes to him, appears to him, and says, "Rebuild my church." So again, this story, not quite the same story. It's not told, Francis's life was not the same, but in essence, a kind of prodigal son story. But she goes on to tell the story that a woman living in Italy had just told them that 15 years before the now, when she was in Italy with Jyotish and Devi, she was living in a small town in southern Italy. And every year they had a day of celebration where they had a procession with the Madonna. They carried a statue, they walked Madonna through the streets, and then they put her back into her church at the end of the day. And this woman sat down and was praying, very much as Francis had done, in front of this painted wooden cross, when Christ literally came out of the cross and stood in front of Francis and said, "Rebuild my church." This woman was sitting in front of the Madonna, just praying, she said, like she had never prayed before. And the Blessed Mother just came out to her and said to her, "You are the only one in this church who is here to see me." And she said to the Blessed Mother, who was there right in front of her, "But Mother, the church is filled with people." And she said, "Yes, but you are the only one who came to see me they all came to be seen. It's a very powerful story. And then she asked her to build a shrine in a small town away from there, which after many years and apparently many miracles later, she did. So I tell these stories really because when we turn to God, and Devi says in her writing, I won't get her words exactly right, but she said when we speak to God in God's language of pure, selfless love, then we're just right there. We're right there with him. This reading from the Gita is so beautiful because basically it says, come out of the fog of all of your self-definitions. Quit thinking, I'm a woman, I live in California, I'm a doctor, I'm a minister, I'm good at this, I'm not that. Come out of all of that, calm the waves that are created by that fog. You know, I'm just reading a book right now about the Lusitania. And it's quite a remarkable book in many ways. But the captain of the Lusitania had worked for this British shipping company for 30 or 40 years before he was allowed to take a ship out on his own. A really experienced man who loved the sea. And he had gone back and forth from Ireland and England, I mean, dozens and dozens of times without a mishap. He was a real hero. There's many, many stories about him that are amazing about how many lives he saved. So interesting that he was on the Lusitania. But he says in there, he wrote many times in his books, that the worst thing for any captain of any ship is fog on the sea. He said, because when you get into a fog, you have no idea where you are. The next ship can be 3 yards, 30 yards, 300 yards. You simply can't see and you don't know until you're back in a clear sky again. And when I read that, it just hit me. That's what our lives are about. We are in a fog. And until we get ourselves out of this fog by exactly what the Gita says, by calming the waves, the disturbing waves that are created by all of these self-definitions, we cannot know where we are. We are trying to satisfy ourselves, to please ourselves, without being in tune with the divine. And no matter how many times we try, and there's an infinite number of ways to keep trying, we cannot know what we're looking for without the divine behind it. We will search and search, but until it is God-inspired, we won't know it. Happiness comes in all the predictable ways. A good marriage, a nice vacation, some good work that you did at your job. That's what happiness is. Joy, true joy, it comes miraculously only from the inside. Only when we know God. That is our job. That is what we're doing here. We're falling, we're getting up. We're not wasting a moment apologizing, telling ourselves how bad we are, telling ourselves how undeserving we are. We are deserving of everything. We are everything. Even if I had bought the cashmere sweater, okay, I got the sweater, I'll wear it, I'll enjoy it. Where am I going next? We just keep turning back to the light and we find ourselves walking right into the arms of our Father who's just been waiting for us to come, who sees us as he always saw us, as perfect, who wants to put on the robes, put on the rings, give us sandals, give us the best meal imaginable just because we're home. That's the celebration. That's the joy.